Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Beyond the Game. My name is Gregan, and today I'm talking with Tom Bismire, known more commonly by his alias, Tom Biz.
Can you just tell me, what's the biggest thing I need to do? And he, a few years later, he said to me, he was like, I wish I never gave you that advice because you're now better than me and it's annoying. In secondary school, I was the ultimate like introvert. Like I would, if you put me in front of anything, I would have been like, no, absolutely not. There's no way I'm doing that. But like, he's a bit of a chunkier guy. And those skinny jeans will haunt me to this day. He's not bad at the game, but some of the times you'll call an entire strat and then he'll go, sorry, I wasn't listening.
I like to think he's got other priorities like being a father. And
yeah, maybe. Yeah,
he does sometimes say, sorry, I'm going to have to AFK for a round.
Yeah, if you're choosing your kids over me, I'm not happy with that.
Make sure to follow for future episodes. It really does mean a lot. I hope you enjoy this conversation as we get to know Tom Biz beyond the game. Right, Tom, welcome.
Thank you.
We've had a little bit of fun before we started here, and we've been chatting a little bit while we had some food. Mm. And there's loads of stuff we want to talk about with you, but as every story begins with gaming when you're younger, I want to find out what you were like as a young Tom gaming and what led you to where you are now.
What was I like as a young Tom? As in like what game started it or how I got into
yeah,
it?
Well, yeah, what kind of gaming did you get into at the beginning?
I feel like it was like No, actually, it probably was Game Boy Color. The old school Pokemon Silver. I feel like I got to a point where I definitely cheated as well in those games, even as a kid, which I'm not saying I took that into my later life. But
did you ever do Action Replay? The Action cartridge Replay. Thing? So there was, for DS, there was a cartridge you could put into your game which allow you to cheat stuff in. I did it for Pokemon. And then once I started cheating and started getting like level 100 Arceus into the game, I was like, this is no fun anymore. It takes away from the
I still remember,
mechanics.
So on the Game Boy Color, you had those little pink cables that you had to like put to each other's thing to be able to play versus each other. And just someone I knew had like cheated in like a level 100 Mew, level 100 Moltres. And I was like, I'll be having one of those and just give it a go. But it definitely does sort of end the game when you get to that point. But I think when you're a kid, you play them so much that it's like, everything was level 100 anyway, so
exactly.
Might as well have the good ones.
There was duplication glitches in the Game Boy games as well, and all sorts of other just inbuilt glitches into the game. You know, people complain about the glitches you see today, but games have got a lot cleaner since then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think also that, and like, I think I had a Sega Mega Drive, so I was like playing like old school Sonic games.
When I started doing this podcast, I didn't think I'd hear this much Sega Mega Drive, but this is the third of five guests who's brought up the Sega Mega Drive.
You need to pick some younger people. You're going for all the old people, evidently. I had another console that I don't even remember the name of, like the old people consoles that had like some cool fighting games and stuff on it. But I think the proper like getting into gaming was when I got like the original Xbox. Which for people who are young, that's like before the 360, before the Xbox One, before whatever. I don't even know. Is what's someone called now? I really feel old.
I think it's still Xbox One, but they've just added a letter or something afterwards to make it upgraded.
I mean, I'm seeing heads being shaken.
I mean, what? Series X, there we go.
We're both PC
guys. Yeah, PC now.
But like playing the original Halo, stuff like that. That's what really got me into gaming, and that's what made me a competitive little shit.
And was it shooters then?
Yes.
That was your first shooter, Halo?
I don't know if it would have been my first, but it was definitely the one I remember the most. Like getting into Halo, Gears was another game that I shouldn't have been playing, but absolutely loved. I think it was like one of my cousins got me into that, and he was like, look, you can chainsaw through someone's face. And I'm like, yes, I need this game.
How old were you when this was happening?
Not old enough. I don't know, but I want to say like 10, 12, something like that. Like watching him chainsaw people through the face and being like, that's a cool game. I need to own that.
And so what happened after that? What got you to the CSGO age?
The thing is, it took me a long time to even get anywhere near sort of PC gaming. Like I was also always into stuff like FIFA. And then I must have been like maybe 15, 16 when I decided to get myself a PC because I was like, okay, there's a lot of cool games. I'm watching people play these sort of things and on like YouTube and stuff, and I'd like to give them a go. And so that was when I think the first game I properly played on PC was Garry's Mod because it was like £2. So it's like I have an absurd amount of hours in Garry's Mod. I mean like maybe 2,000 hours in Garry's Mod.
Just playing all like, the different games?
Yeah, playing like the old prop hunt, like Trouble in Terrorist Town.
Oh, I used
like,
to love all, Trouble all in Terrorist Town.
That was my addiction.
So for me, Trouble in Terrorist Town, I played it with a group where we all got on very well. We knew each other really well. Yeah. I was terrible at shoots at the time. I barely played any. So I wasn't very good at winning by killing people. So I had to use my manipulation skills, which it turns out with Among Us and Trouble in Terrorist Town, that's my strongest asset in those kind of games. So I'd always leave it to a point where it'd be me plus two other people and be like, well, it's one of you two. You should shoot each other.
Yeah. No, I was the opposite. Like I got so good at that game that I would then start like when I was the terrorist, just start buying these like weapons that are bad. Like trying to, there was like a physics gun where you could just knock people off. And that was basically my game. I'd just try and see how many people I could knock off the edge before eventually I got blamed for it. But yeah, no, those games were what got into it originally. And then I started like watching stuff on Twitch and seeing CSGO and like giving it a go. I was dreadful. I was like that kid running around with a P90 and just trying to spray down as many people as possible. But when you start seeing like these pro players, and obviously CS always advertised it like on the homepage. So you get like these blips of people commenting and stuff, and that's what sort of got me into it.
So was there stuff in your childhood that you remember leaning you towards the commentary side, or was it once you started commentating, that was the first experience of the public speaking side of things?
I did a little bit of like presentation style stuff when I was at uni. In secondary school, I was the ultimate like introvert. Like I would, if you put me in front of anything, I would have been like, no, absolutely not. There's no way I'm doing that. But like with a university, they kind of force you to do presentations. Like I was doing marketing. So there's a lot of stuff like that where it's like you trying to sell something or basically going in front of a group. So that definitely built any level of confidence I had up, but I was definitely still not like, hey, I'm going to go on camera. That's going to be where I work.
So when was the shift for you with CSGO and going into commentary?
The main thing, when I finished my degree, I was just like, I don't want to do sales. And when you come out with a marketing degree, it's like you get emails from like 4,000 sales companies being like, we do it, like this crazy marketing scheme. It's like, is it me calling people and going, hey, do you want to buy this? And they were like, no. And so I saw that and I hated it. So I did the thing that everybody does who loves esports and went to a dodgy website called, well, I don't know if it's dodgy, but it seemed dodgy, called esportsjobs.com, which was something that any human being could list on. Like, I genuinely think you could, if it still exists, you can go there today and just put like, I need esports commentary. But there was a small Lithuanian company who was just like, we send anybody in the universe can send in a VOD. So I just went on like, there's like the top games going on in CSGO. I just took one of those and just like commentated over it. I was just like, I'll see if I can do it because I didn't want like a traditional office job. It just never appealed to me.
Well, that's the big bit of advice most commentators give when someone says, how can I get into this? They'll say, just find a VOD of a game that you thought was a good game. Try commentating over it. And if you're good at it and you send that off to someone, they will give you a try.
I was coincidentally very lucky because one of the people in that game, for anybody who does know CS, was a guy called Nato Safix, who I'm now quite good friends with. And it was, I went in his stream afterwards and went, I commentated over your game. Will you look at it? And because he'd done a few broadcasts here and there, I was like, can you just tell me what's the biggest thing I need to do? And he, a few years later, he said to me, he was like, I wish I never gave you that advice because you're now better than me and it's annoying.
Well, it's weird because there's the story there, you haven't really got any hints at why you were a good commentator beforehand. So for me, I did a lot of public speaking before I went to commentary. So it made sense to me. I went on and public speaking plus Rocket League knowledge meant Rocket League commentator.
I don't think I was a good commentator. That's the bit that, like, I just have that sort of the British accent. So I was doing a lot of like Lithuanian broadcasts and stuff. So the first LAN events I did were Lithuania. There was one in Estonia. So like they couldn't really get English speak. Like not fluent English, but people who are from England to come and do their events. So just having someone who was English and willing to do it, I grinded out a lot of online casts, and I had people in the scene just critique me and just be like, this is shit. Like, I always bring up, I went to the Faceit Studios, not to work, just because I spoke to James Bardoff and DDK, and they were like, bring us a VOD and we'll have a look at it. And by that point, I had done some other stuff, like some qualifiers and some other things, and they just ripped the shit out of me for an hour. Just like, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And that's why I improved. Because ultimately, I came in and I was very sort of monotone, like, oh, they're going to push towards this. And I knew the game because I had a few thousand hours in it at that point, and I watched probably more esports than most people, I'd imagine. I just sat there every day, just esports one monitor playing on another. But like, that was it. It was just someone was willing to go, you are dog shit. Please fix this, 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 and this. And then I'd do that. And then I'd go back to another person and send it to a load of different people in the scene.
I guess the willingness to take on feedback is the biggest learning point from that, because anyone can put the hours in and grind it out. But if you just do the same thing over and over again and don't improve, you're never going to get anywhere. Yeah. And you're willing to put yourself out there, take on feedback. And
it does suck. Yeah. I will say to anybody who, because no matter, like, every time you'll go back and you'll be like, okay, this time I have improved. So maybe the criticism won't be as harsh, but if someone is genuinely trying to help you, it will be. Like, there is no, obviously if you're friends or if you watch a commentary and you go, I think that was really good, and you tell your friend, I think that was really good, that's nice, but that doesn't benefit them really. Like, they will either just try and replicate that cast, which you can't do. It's not possible to cast another game the same way you just did the last one. You could take elements, but the only way people ever get better is just, sorry, that was shit, like, this was bad, I didn't like this.
Yeah, well, the CSGO casting sort of was the start of your esports career. Yep. You're now known probably more for your Valorant casting, as you're definitely one of the most popular duos in Valorant. Definitely one of my favorites. I'm a big fan of the British style and also the comedic style. So I think having you and Mitch, that duo of
he'll love that you've called it the British style. He'll really appreciate that.
He was the comedic style, you're the British style. Oh, okay. So okay, it was a combination of the two. But yeah, that sort of...
You can call him British, he's fine with it.
The humour that we have in Britain, that Mitch Mann also has a good grasp on. But yeah, the combination of you two reminds me a lot of, in Rocket League, we have a duo, Stumpy and Cole. They're very entertaining, very funny. And as they got knowledge of the game as well, they became, in my mind, one of my favorite duos, because you get the entertainment if it's a bad game, and then you also get the quality of analysis when it's a good game, and the hype when it's a good game, and all that kind of stuff. So you guys have all of those components. When did you and Mitch first meet as a duo?
When did we first meet, or when did we start as a duo? Because those are two very,
I guess,
different
things. Tell both sides.
So the first time I met Mitch was at some like small ESL like qualifier thing for one of the events. It was like, I was casting with Jason Kaplan, who now does a lot of stuff in like PUBG, and he's done everything, I think, at this point. And I think Mitch was casting with, I think it was Dean. I might be wrong on that. Could be someone else. But I remember meeting him. The first thing I found out about Mitch was that at that event, he only had one pair of trousers after traveling from another event. And those trousers were skinny jeans. And the people have met Mitch. He's a bit of a chunkier guy. And those skinny jeans will haunt me to this day. And every time I bring it up, his response is, well, why were you looking there? And I'm like, there was nowhere else to look. Like, so it's just, I think just sort of laughing and joking with each other from the very, very get-go of just someone that was like good vibes to be around, I guess. And then first cast was, I think it was by coincidence. It was basically one of the, I think it was probably in CS. We did PGL stuff. Now the PGL stuff was exactly the sort of stuff you were talking about, where it was like very, they wanted us to have fun because it was like 6 a.m. Asian Counter-Strike, where half the teams were mixed teams. There were teams genuinely that turned up who said like, well, one of my teammates has been asleep and literally just woke up 5 minutes ago. This kid's really angry. Like, they literally like smack talking each other on Twitter. Like, my team are dreadful, be back tomorrow. And so it was like some of the games, you just have some of the worst players you've ever seen while playing up against some good teams. So it was like, you had to almost laugh and joke and be silly about it. And I think like even the production team, one of them, they made a record, like a fully edited photo of me as Thomas the Tank Engine, and then just started playing music. Like, this was during the broadcast. So it was one of those things where basically me and him were just paid to try and entertain a game that's not entertaining. So it was almost like going through the fire from the get-go. And in Valorant, it sort of came about just by coincidence. I think Banks was busy one day, or I think something had happened. So basically, I stood in, but it wasn't something I think that was ever planned. It just happy coincidence.
So what's it like as a commentator when you do find that duo where you're like, okay, this is what I want to work with in every show possible, and you got that rapport, you've got that instant connection and things like that?
I'll let you know when I find it. No, I'm just...
I mean, that was a lot of assumption there from me.
No, I think it's very much just, firstly, synergy, I think, is still one of the most important things. I think it's something that a lot of companies don't necessarily understand. Still, like, I haven't had it so much recently in Valorant, but at the beginning, it was definitely a thing of just like, oh, we're just going to keep mixing stuff up because it keeps it fresh. And it's like, yes, I agree, it keeps it fresh. But if you don't have, like, I can go into a cast with Mitch, I know roughly what I'm going to get. I know that we're going to leave space at certain times and certain places. And we've set almost, even though our cast will not seem structured in the way that we commentate, it very much, we do look a lot back at our timings. Like, that's our biggest thing is like, okay, is it interesting for people to listen to me talk about something for a minute and 20 seconds when a round is maybe 2 minutes, including some of this pause time? It's like, no, not really. Like, you want that back and forth. You want it to be conversational because then you feel like you're involved. So that's something that we very much worked on, was like, okay, let's get that back and forth. And I've casted with so many people in CS, and everybody's different. Like, some color casters will like you to just give it to them at the end of the round so they can explain everything and break it down. Some color casters might want to tell you something mid-round, like, I really loved this, this was great, and so you then have to give them space there. Some play-by-plays want to do every hype moment. Some want to do the ones that fit. So it's like, with mine and Mitch's duo, it very much is more of a like flow. Like, we try and sort of mix things up a little bit more. So it's been quite refreshing that every day that I go in, I know that we're going to enjoy ourselves, because I'm not ever going to be sat there just like, damn, this guy really wants every single play-by-play moment. Or he's not going to be sit there going like, I actually had something to say there, but I can't say it because Tom's just explaining everything.
Yeah, I guess it takes the competitive edge that could be there with casting of, yeah, I need to be the star, to, yeah, we need to be the star duo. And so it gives you that teamwork element.
Exactly.
That makes it more long-term when you're working together, because you can building that structure and so on. But we've spoken about Valorant and CSGO, two massive games in your life, but I ask every guest what their top five games are of all time. I wonder if those are in there. You can take it however you want. You can say influence, you can say enjoyment. It's up to you how you read into top five. And I know you've been struggling a little bit before the show to work out what yours are.
I don't, putting either Valorant or CSGO on top is difficult, because it's like, right now it will obviously be Valorant because that's my life. But if I'm going over my overall esports career, CSGO was longer, and also what I played a lot with my mates. So those two, I don't know where to put those two, because I had different parameters. They'll be in different places, so people can read into that what they will. Other than that, I think already mentioned like Halo and Gears of War. I'll put Gears of War 2, because that was the one that Gears of War was the one my cousin showed me where I shouldn't have been playing it, and Gears of War 2, by the age rating, I definitely still shouldn't have been playing it, but I plunged an insane amount of hours to that game. And that's probably the only game I'll say I think I was actually good at. Like, I'm okay at Valorant. I was okay at CS, but Gears of War 2, I think I was genuinely good, like, because I just grinded a ridiculous amount of hours in that game. Halo, again, probably either 1 or 2. Like, both of them I just played a million times through those campaigns as a kid. Like, I just loved those games. And then, so I was trying to think what Mario game to put in. I was going to, for the meme, put like Nintendo Wii World at War COD, because I did play quite a bit of that. And I will say, it is fun.
Was that the one where you pointed at the screen, yes, with the Wii remote?
Get the grenade launcher and just like yeet it up into the air using the Wii remote. Like that game was fun.
Did you get the you could put a casing around the nunchuck?
Mitch was telling me about that. I didn't get that. No, I was just playing like this, like with the nunchuck. I think I was all right at that game as well. But no, I think I'd probably say like Mario Kart.
Which, like, one?
Probably the Nintendo Wii one.
To be fair, amongst the Mario Kart community, the Wii version of Mario Kart is by far the most popular long term. You know, it's similar with the Smash Bros.
Series.
Definitely knew that. Melee is the one which everyone looks back on. Oh, that was the best one in the series. Mm. The mechanics are amazing. For Mario Kart, the Wii version is the one which has kept going. They've got modding. They've got a whole community around it. So, well,
I didn't know any of that, but that is the one that I fondly remember the most. But I think it was also just like, that was probably the one I played most with my friends and mixed in drinking games with, which I don't know why we did the drinking games that we'd... Our game was you'd have the Wii remote in one hand, a beer in the other hand, and you basically had to... The person who finished last in the race of your friends had to do a shot, and if you didn't finish the beer during the race, you had to do a shot.
I've heard variations on Mario Kart with drinking games where it's if you come first, you have to drink, because that way it makes them get gradually worse and worse.
No.
So they don't sustain that victory run as long as possible.
No, we were... You punished the loser.
Punished.
Which did, I will say, meant I didn't have to drink as much.
Because you were good at the game.
The only problem is I also, of all of my friends, probably had the lowest tolerance for alcohol. So downing the beer was enough to... I got to that point anyway. Because I would just down the beer at the very start of the race.
That's
and then just
3 minutes a race of per drink. Did you take a pause between each race or did you just go...
I think after like four or five races, there was a long pause.
A little reset.
But no, that was kind of brutal. We tried to do it with games like FIFA as well, but it got to a point of stupidity because it's like, if you say every time you score, if there's a 0-0 game, it's boring. So I think one of my friends genuinely said, every time the ball goes out of play, you do a drink. Which... It's brutal.
I've heard so many variations on drinking games for video games. I didn't realize until working in Rocket League and speaking to people about it from uni and stuff that Rocket League became a popular drinking game. And it's a similar kind of thing to the
just
FIFA.
Every goal?
Yeah, just goals, or I guess every time someone gets demoed, maybe you could, I don't know, you could do all sorts of things with it. But yeah, it seems like Mario Kart and the football style games tend to be quite good drink games. All the shooters are a little bit too hardcore for the drinking environment.
Yeah, I also feel like you'd lose your mechanics very quickly in a shooting game.
That
like,
is true.
I feel like in racing games, you could still kind of finish the race, but like if you're just like everywhere with the, I don't think that would work.
Yeah, especially the PC shooters like the Valorants and CSGOs where the mechanics are very specific.
If you're against anyone else, you're just going to get trounced.
Yeah. So that was your top five games into a little bit of drinking game culture. Mario Kart, the memories being linked to the...
I still played a crap ton of Mario Kart outside of that, but that's just like, that's what I remember. It's just a group of friends just drinking and playing that. So
a whole range there from your career to the games you've grinded out to the ones which you played socially.
I definitely didn't have the same drinking mentality with CSGO.
That's for sure.
I would have got slammed.
And so with that, I want to ask you, what do you consider to be your greatest ever gaming achievement?
Ooh. That one's actually a little bit more difficult. I feel like doing like, I think in the Wii version of that Mario Kart, like doing all of the reverse and like 200cc, like I went through and did like all of that shit. So that's probably up there with it. I think in Gears of War, again, I had like nearly every achievement. And I still remember one of my friends, there's like an achievement in that, which is like get, I think it's like 100,000 kills or something. And it's just a waste of time. But he got bet to do it. And so he did it. And he basically was just replaying this same level over and over again where you're this giant sort of, you kidnap this monster. And yeah, I think the bet was for like 10 quid. And he wasted like days of his life. So it wasn't worth it. But no, I think it'd be something like that. Like just going through all of the Mario Kart. So I wouldn't say like, my success in gaming as a playing is very good. So,
well, I mean, for the pro players are going to come in here and say their greatest ever finish, but with the commentary side, saying I commentated at this event, it doesn't feel like a gaming achievement. It still feels like a work achievement.
I would say I'm quite proud of the fact that in terms of Masters events in Valorant, the fact that so far I've been at every single like international Masters or Champions is something I didn't, because especially the so I did one cast of the like non-international Masters with Mitch, and that was my first ever like VCT cast. And then the next Masters I was invited, and I will say like of the more recent ones, I was like optimistic of being there because I've done all the stuff in the VCT, like done. But with that first Masters, like the Iceland one that nobody actually went to Iceland, I didn't expect to be on it at all. Because I was like, I think we're getting there as a duo, but we'd only been casting together like a couple of months. So that the fact that I still can say that I've done all of them so far, that means a lot to me for sure.
I think we can classify that as a gaming achievement.
Also doing an ESL 1 in CSGO, like doing a Bella Horizonte. Because that was... That's why I'm so happy that this next event is going to Brazil, because Belo Horizonte, I think there was, it was CSGO, there was like 10,000 fans in that room. Nothing like it. Like nothing like it. You just sit there staring, and you feel weird, because I think there's like a Bo Burnham thing where he's like, we say that like comedy is like everybody is in this together, like we're having a chat and you're laughing along, but the fact is all of you are looking at me. And that was sort of how it felt in that Belo Horizonte moment. It's like, even though the cast was in Portuguese, I'm facing 10,000 people. I was like, because that's how they set the casters up. Literally, like, I was here and all the fans were. I mean, well, basically where Harry is, but they can't see him. So
like five meters yeah. away. Yeah.
It's just absurd. And yeah.
You feel that energy because their energy is linked to the game and your energy is linked to the game. Yeah. So you're in sync with your energy. You definitely feel that.
I also casted, I think it was MIBR at that event, getting eliminated. Silent. And I don't know if you've ever been in a room with that many people not saying a word. It's terrifying. So it's both one of the greatest and one of the scariest. Because yeah. I was just like...
That eerie silence of disappointment.
Well, and I'm shouting at the other team winning.
Yeah. So you're the bad guy in the room yeah. then. Yeah. Well, the whole career you've had is only just getting started, really, with Valorant, hopefully, in the future. And I think your journey is definitely one that a lot of people listen to and think, oh, I didn't realize you could get into it that way, where you just start shooting yeah, your yeah. shot out and just sending VODs and just putting the work in, asking for feedback. So definitely a lot to learn there for people. With these kinds of jobs, though, it seems like a dream job, which it is. We're all very lucky to do what we yeah. do. But there are challenges linked to it. And in particular, the challenges of things like right now is the off season. And we were speaking earlier before we went on. Off seasons are not a fun time to be a commentator.
No. Well, no, it's like a lot of it is. I think there is always that dream of people where you like the idea of having that extra freedom, which I do enjoy. Like the fact that I can take a break, I can go on a holiday, yada, yada. But there's always been, especially before Valorant, where there was no real set season. Like in CSGO, it's anybody can do an event anywhere. Okay, they have their like month off in the middle, but people ignore that. And so you kind of just, I've had stuff planned where someone's gone, can you do this tomorrow? Fly here. And I've gone, yeah, well, I do like being paid. So I then just do it. And I've given up on like family stuff and different things. And I think also, as I said, like I think Valorant has been a lot better because people have been more willing to give me schedules for stuff, which is very appreciative. But it's just like, it is that sort of extra stress almost of just like, I don't know when my next paycheck is coming. And even though every day up until this point I've done fine, tomorrow I could never be hired again. And I think most people in esports, even to the very, very top level, still have that mentality of like, if I don't have something booked, I need to get something booked. And so your time off is not time off. Mm-hmm. It's like, for example, now like trying to make videos, because I'm just like, I need to fill the void with something, because I can't just sit and just, I can't do what I would have done as a kid and just been like, I'm just going to play 17 hours of video games. It's like, I would love to do that, but I just can't.
Yeah, and it's the high highs of, you know, you've just come off of the biggest Valorant event and it was an amazing experience to then nothingness.
The LAN blues.
Yeah, the LAN blues followed by months of downtime where you're wondering if you're going to be back doing something. And then there is that added competition, which we spoke about of, you know, sometimes you'll be doing an event, sometimes you have a month off.
Yeah.
What's that experience like for you with the competition and knowing whether you're going to be going to the next event? Are you the kind of person who sees it as, I need to be the best caster possible? And like you did in your early days, you're like, I need to hone my craft to be the number one duo. And
I think the main thing is like, I'll always try and dive into doing something. Like it's like, I can never take, normally what I do is I'll do an event and then immediately after that event, maybe I'll take a week off, like go on a holiday. I've only done that more recently. I didn't do that in the past, but I would just grind whatever I could, be that. Maybe I'd go and watch some other event, like just try and pick up pieces that other people are doing and go, actually, I like that. I could do that. Be it try and make content with Mitch or someone like that, like I've been doing Valorant recently. But that's a whole different ball game of just like, especially in off seasons, you're like, nothing is happening and I need to try and make a video. Mm-hmm. So that's been tough. And I've never been particularly good at that sort of content side, because it's like, I will have certain motivations and it's like, oh, I want to do this now. And then if I can't do it now, it just very frustrating. So I think like I'm always working to some degree. And I think my one of the things that always irritates me most is turning off my brain to just enjoy myself somewhere. Because even I will still, like, I'm not the sort of person, you know, when you see in like movies where it's like, oh, I'll just turn my phone off for a week and just enjoy myself. I will never be able to do that. I'll always be on like Twitter. I'm a social media addict, but also I will, if someone sends me a message about like a job, I will respond to it probably within like 20 minutes.
So always connected. And I guess anything that's going on, you'll be watching it. You said you used to be glued to CSGO back in the day. So you'll probably be watching lots of esports. You'll be watching content that people are putting out and constantly involved in things that are going on. How does that affect you mentally? So you said you struggle to switch off, which is a massive struggle for a lot of people in the esports world. And it's, and we had Mystic on, who was talking about off season and after tournaments, the ability to switch off and find purpose when they're not training, practicing and things like that. It's very hard to deal with that.
Yeah, it's something I will never be good at. I think I've just come to accept that I have to. So one of the main things, so like more recently, I've been trying to lose weight because that was a good thing to do in the meantime of just like, okay, I got to a ridiculous point because my void filler was eating food. Like that was basically, I'd just be like, I'll just order myself a load of fried chicken. I had a bad day. I'll do this. And so it's like, I got to a peak of weight. And in the past, it's like, if I don't, I think everybody to some degree needs to have like some sort of coping mechanism with like the ups and downs of general life. But for me, when I was younger, especially like probably from the age of maybe 17 to 24 or something like that, I suffered from panic attacks. So mine was sort of through overthinking and all of these different things. Like I had medical panic attacks. Like it might have been, oh, I have a pain in my shoulder. It could be the wrong shoulder. And I'd be like, maybe it's a heart problem. And then I just go down this terrible spiral road. So it's like, that's not something that has affected me too much in work. Because once I'm focused and once I'm involved in something, I don't really get those same sort of like issues. But it is off-season stuff. It's like, okay, I need to do stuff because if I sit here, I'm going to be in my own head and spiral into oblivion. So it'll be like, oh, why haven't I heard about this yet? It's because of this. It's because of this. And even though, like, this is the one thing I'll say with, like, any sort of, like, mental thing, the most rational thing can be right in front of you. And you'll ignore it almost just to allow yourself to spiral, which that's something that I think is why I have to have a focus. Like, be it, it could be something silly, like even just getting an achievement in a video game, or just like, okay, I want to go through and create all of a script for a video that I'm not even going to record for a month. It's just like, to have something to focus on is great. And so, for example, a lot of the reason I did lose some weight was because I went, okay, minimum I want to walk 10,000 steps a day. So every day I would get up, I'd do a walk to the shops, I'd get whatever I was going to eat for lunch, come back. And then in the evening, I do exactly the same thing. And so it's just having that rhythm of something. Okay, I'm going to put some hours into a video. I'm going to put some hours into playing FIFA, which is a game I hate with a passion. It makes me so angry. But it's like there's always goals in that game. So it's like, okay. And that wasn't even a intended pun, but it's a good one. But it's like it's something where I go, okay, now that I'm doing something, it's fine. But if I just sat there and just was like doing nothing, that's where my head wanders into not great space.
How old are you now?
28.
So you've had this for 10 years where you've understood it and you found a way to deal with it through your own lifestyle changes and doing positive changes with your habits.
I'll briefly explain what I understand panic attacks to be. I'm sure that many people would just think of it as like something you could have once or twice, but for me it was like a disorder. So I was on like citalopram, which for anybody who doesn't know is like basically a depression pill, and it sort of dulls your emotions a bit. And for me it was more once I believed what panic attacks were, because in my head I was like, he's telling me it's a panic attack, but I believe I'm dying of a horrible disease. So that sort of dulls it enough to you go, okay, I am that. And then once I believe what something is, it's fine. But basically what it would do is, for me, it would recreate symptoms of real illnesses. So like I would have a thumping heart, I would have trouble breathing, I would have like basically feel like I was about to drop dead in the next 3 seconds, and in reality I'm absolutely fine. Like it got to, I think at the worst point I could feel burning like down my arms and stuff. So it was not like it's one of those things where you go like, oh, mental illness, it's like, ah, that person feels a bit sad, or that person, like, for people who don't understand it, but it can actually cause you sort of real symptoms of real illnesses, and in reality, you're having to try and home those in. But for me, what it was is, once I had been through that medication, I understood what illness it was. You can create coping mechanisms. So for a few years, at least, what I would do is I would put my fingers here. So if I felt like I couldn't breathe, I would go, and you instantly feel your sort of rib cage rise, and that tells me I'm breathing. Even though for anybody in a normal scenario, they go, Tom, you can feel your breathing because you're not lying on the floor passed out. But it's like, that was my coping thing. So when it comes to life nowadays, it's like, okay, I might have a panic attack once every 6 months because I'm like incredibly tired or in a bad mental state or something like that. But once I realize that's what's happening, it's very easy for me to just go, okay, I'm going through this now. I need to calm myself. I need to slow my breathing. And it's all those different coping mechanisms. And also then just in life in general, it's like, okay, I'll be a bit healthier so that I'm not going to feel like rough or ill or have be really bloated or something, which could then lead to me thinking it's something else. It's like I remove all of those factors and then it's much less likely to happen. So I think everybody's going to be different. Like that worked for me because I think I've always been told by a lot of my friends the way my brain works is very, very rational. So it's like if I can rationalize something, I can cope with it quite easily. Like be it in work, like, okay, I know for a fact that this has happened because of this, so I don't need to worry about it because ultimately either there was nothing I could do or if there was, it's already passed. So it's like rationalizing those different things, or be it like, say like people get stressed in the off season because of contracts or whatever coming up in the future. I go, can I affect this decision now? No, I can't. I could spam message everybody who I want to work with, but they'll just be like, this guy's a bit weird. I probably shouldn't respond to him.
So I guess you can apply that for a lot of people with dating as well. That's probably the place where people struggle the most with the logical thinking of, you know, oh, what are they thinking? Why are they not messaging back?
Yeah, exactly.
And so on. And actually you can, if you just take a step back and rationalize it. I don't know if you've, there's actually a book just behind you, Chimp Paradox, which is a really good book that goes into the way our brain works. Oh, Pig Wrestling is a great book too. I haven't referenced the shelf behind for any other guests so far, but for the audio listeners, there is a few books on the shelf just behind Tom that are great books to help my brain when I was developing the way I think and everything. And I'm very similar to you. I'm a very logical thinker. I actually did a profiling tool, which came out as a empathic, logical, a prudent thinker. So I tend to think of the worst case scenario quite naturally rather than optimistic. And I had to train myself to do the other parts of the way your brain works, because everyone can do everything. It's just you have preferences. And for you, you've learned how to use your preferences to help in that situation. Now, for someone else, they might have to do something like self-talk, where they'll be shouting at themselves and in their head, and they'll be like, don't be silly, you're fine. And that'll be their way of dealing with it.
Well, it's like I think one of the best pieces of advice is if you ever receive a message that like maybe makes you angry or annoyed, it's just like wait 5 minutes and then respond. Because the first thing you're ever going to send is going to be something that could damage you, or because you go, okay, this person, I'm mad. You put that down, you wait 5 minutes, you're not as mad anymore. And I think that's it's the same way with what you were talking about with thinking of the worst scenario. It's like your brain will a lot of the time instantly go, oh, this has happened because of this. But then you think about it for a little bit longer and you can think of a much more likely scenario than the one that you thought of maybe when you were upset or when you were angry and all these different things. And I think that links back into what I was saying, where it's like, oh, my heart is racing. Is it because, say, at the time I'm 23 years old and having a heart attack? Well, a doctor has told me that if that ever happened, they would send me in for some sort of special autopsy because they've checked every one of my vitals and it would have to be random. So what's it more likely to be? Is it because I'm over breathing? Is it because I'm overthinking? And I think in a sense, I've taken the things I learned from when I was younger that I had to deal with just the panic attacks to, okay, how can I apply that somewhere in my life? So it's like, okay, has this person reacted this way because of this ridiculous thing that I just thought up instantly, or is it because of the one of 50 other things it could be?
Yeah, and that's the center of your brain is a lot more powerful than the higher thinking human side of your brain. And that's what the chimp paradox is all about, is the chimp in your brain has got a lot more control over that initial thought.
Yeah.
And if you take a moment, like you said, 5 minutes, whatever it is, just to take a moment and actually think about it, you start going, actually, well, that's a bit silly, isn't it? And then that's where you can start to come up with those conclusions. But you mentioned about the panic attack disorder, and it was sort of in your late teens, early adulthood.
Yeah.
Talk about the time scale of when it was at its worst, because you mentioned now it's every 6 months you might have a panic attack.
Yeah,
and you've got control over it now. When was it at its worst? What was the first experience of sort of coming to terms with it and understanding it?
The worst was definitely like probably the first few days, or the first few days were the very, very peak, but it was still bad for maybe a year, because it's like, that was when I think I was still in like sixth form. So that's like
17
years of age. And it's like, you're getting something that ultimately has no cure. It's not something that, like, you can cover it, you can sort of get around it, which is basically what I do now, but it's not gone, it's just better. So it's like, for example, I just remember lying in bed, I can't breathe sitting up, lying in bed, I can't breathe sitting up. And it was just that, didn't sleep for weeks. I actually got diagnosed with insomnia as well, because of it was all caused by that. And I think I had a slight OCD, like just checking lights and like things where my brain was just like, you need to do this, you need to do this. So it's like, that was definitely at its worst. I think like I was very lucky with like so I went to like the child therapy sort of stuff, and that didn't work for me because it's someone basically trying to tell me a problem I don't really believe in. And then it was like, that's when I got given proper medication and quite a high dose of it as well, where it basically just nulled everything. And from then onwards, it started to gradually improve. And I had doctors who were good in the sense that they read me as a person and knew that if they bullshitted me, it wasn't going to work. And I think that's why, like with the original therapist, that was like talking to me about like, is it this? I'm like, I don't know. Is it this? I don't know. Is it this? And you just kind of waste hours and hours of time and through frustration. And then they just put me on something that ultimately allowed me to do it on my own. Because I'm like, okay, they have given me something that ultimately is for the thing they have told me I have. I now know for sure that I don't have any super secret disease that is going to kill me, which the doctors probably would have found immediately. And now I can just sort of like start coping with it. And there have definitely been moments, even in broadcasts and stuff, where I've gone, oh, I'm feeling a little bit rough. Like maybe I'll go get myself a drink, or I'll go get myself some food, or whatever it may be, just to pick myself back out of that. Like, because sometimes you just feel exhausted or tired, but that's when those sort of like mental illnesses can actually hit you harder because of just the sheer exhaustion of a day's work. And we've all done those like 12, 14 hour broadcast days where by the end of it, you're just like, I'm not even a human being anymore. I'm just a slug that's going to go and crawl back into bed.
Yeah. But, and then you realize you don't have enough time to get enough sleep in to recover from it. And then it spirals.
And then it becomes insomnia because you're like, I need 6 hours of sleep. If I fall asleep now, I'll get 6 hours of sleep. It's like,
but you need to wind down.
I need 5 hours of sleep. So you just have 30 minutes of sleep is fine. Like, but no, it's, I think it's only affected me once or twice on a broadcast, but nowadays, as I say, it's like I know how to bring myself back. So it's like those early years were definitely the worst, and there were still moments of like heavy anxiety, like the first time I did like a presentation at university where my heart felt like it was going to explode just from nerves. But yeah, most of those things nowadays, it's like, I think it will still be the case that the first time I do anything, I'll still get those sort of like butterflies in your stomach, like be it, oh, the first time I'm casting in front of a crowd, like maybe the first 10 minutes, I'm just like, what if they all hate me? What if they all just start going, get out of here, Tom Beers? And I'm like, ah. But, and then after a minute, it's like, nah, I'm fine. Yeah. But I think that's just general nerves nowadays, where I'm not going to be sat there like in a ball like I was when I was younger, like some sort of psycho. But
yeah. And what's really common with illnesses in young people, you mentioned it's a mental illness that you experienced, and you became an expert in it because you understood what it was. You found the right treatment. You were able to self-medicate through lifestyle changes and all those kind of things. And I think what's really important about this conversation is it allows people out there who might be experiencing something similar to be able to go see a doctor if they feel like there might be something wrong. But you also mentioned it's not just mental health, it's an illness. So I wanted to touch on that because I think it is something that's definitely becoming a topic spoken about more and more now, where we're getting to a stage where mental health is starting to bleed into mental illness, where they're different things. I, as someone who have struggled with my mental health at times, you know, recently had quite a bad week of mental health after losing my job. And during that period, I knew it was mental health and not mental illness because it was linked to something in my life. And I knew that I could find my way out of it and I could deal with it. Now, it's important that we all look after our mental health. I'm not saying it's not important, but just explain what the difference between for you with your mental illness versus mental health is for how it felt on your side.
I guess the way I would have put it is, like, firstly, mine was completely random. Like, I was just walking home from school one day and it felt like I was going to just die, basically. But I think that's a very extreme sort of case. The main thing for me is, I think if you, like, anybody can suffer from mental health issues. It's very much a thing. And I think that, like, if it genuinely is something that is causing problems, it doesn't, to me at least, it doesn't matter whether what you call it, whatever it is. All I'd say is just go to a doctor. Like, because I think that's one of the main stigmas nowadays. It's like, if you break your leg, you go to the hospital without a second thought. You don't just go, no, I think I'll just try and walk on this for a few extra days and see how it goes. Whereas with people's mental illnesses, I think that even though it's definitely got better over the last 10 years even, there's still very much that stigma of, oh, why would I go to a doctor for that? I'll just, like, sort of, I'll sleep a bit more. I'll do all these different things. Whereas, like, similarly to when you diagnose, like, muscle pain or, like, I've got problems going to the toilet or all of these different things, you're going to tell these doctors a symptom and then they'll go either, okay, like, maybe you have a mental illness, or they might just straight out go, actually, I think you do and you need to get some help for that. And I think that's the only important topic. Like, I genuinely, like, this is just me personally, I don't care about the difference between any of them. I just think that if people genuinely feel like they're at a point where they need to get some help, they go and get some help. And I will never be one of those people who's like, oh, well, I actually had a mental illness and you are just having a bad week. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, yeah. The only thing that matters is that if there is someone out there who feels like they need some help, they go and get it. Because I can tell you from personal experience, the doctor, maybe you won't find the right person straight away, but if you are at a point where it's like, okay, it could be depression, it could be even just, as you said, like, having a rough week, but if it gets to a point where you're like, okay, this is seriously affecting me, see someone about it, be it the therapist, it's not something I necessarily do so much myself with therapy necessarily, but I think for a lot of people I know, even just seeing a therapist, not even because you need it, just because it's good. It's good to talk through with someone that could be someone you're close to. Like, that could be a friend that you trust to tell all of your different problems or different things in your life. But if you don't have that, or even if you just want an outside point of view, I think therapy is fantastic.
Like, yeah, I think
so good.
Therapy is something I should definitely look into. It's something I've put off for a long time, and I know a lot of my friends have had a lot of success with. But to go back to the doctor thing, I mentioned to you earlier, when I was at uni, I had a leave of absence because I was really struggling. And I went to a doctor to see whether there may be a mental illness there. And the conclusion was, I have low moods linked to my lifestyle, linked to things in my life that, you know, I could get out of without needing medication. And that's the point, is that even if you go to your doctor, you're not going to your doctor and then getting diagnosed.
Yeah,
you're going to your doctor to find out what support you need, whether it is mental health or whether it's mental illness. Because
I think the best way I would say it, I think for me, the comparison would be to something like, maybe you had a chest infection. Like, sometimes the doctor's going to look at you and going to go, actually, I think if you give this a week or two, you eat something healthy, like maybe have some soup or something like that, you'll probably be all right in a week. And sometimes they're going to go, oh, you need antibiotics.
Mm.
And that's the difference. It's like, sometimes the doctor will tell you, actually, I don't think you do have anything crazy bad, but, like, look after yourself, blah, 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 all of these different things. And sometimes they are going to say, okay, this is a bit worse. We need to give you something for that.
And I mean, the most common symptom with every illness is fatigue. And everyone feels tired all the time. You know, I feel tired because I've been overworking or I haven't slept well. But that's the most common symptom on every illness, is feeling fatigued.
Yeah.
So if you're feeling fatigued, you go to a doctor, they might just say to you, hey, I don't see anything else that's linking to something else. Just get a bit more sleep, look after yourself, eat a bit better, get some exercise in, and you'll feel better.
That was the thing that because I was one of those people, especially when I was younger, where it's like, I would have five symptoms. I would Google those five symptoms and they would tell me I have a rare heart condition where if I don't see a doctor, I'm going to die in the next 3 minutes. And then I went to a doctor and they went, you have a panic attack disorder. Like, you have something that is ultimately causing you the symptoms. You're not imagining them. Like, they are real. You are having heart palpitations. You are having, like, pain in certain places that's being caused by this, but ultimately all of that is being caused by your brain, and that's something that we can help you with. So it's like, if I had gone based off just my symptoms alone, I would have, for the next 10 years, started to believe that I was dying. And it's like, I'm going to be dead tomorrow. And then 10 years later, I'm still here. So it's like, the only way that that ever got sorted out for me was to go to a doctor and to talk to someone about it. And I said it might just be, as you said, it's like, okay, I need to work on myself a bit more. But that's ultimately a diagnosis you can get for other things as well, like what people would call like real medical things. And for people listening, I did quote marks there because that's still the problem. It's like with mental illness, people will sit there and go like, oh, well, it's not something I can see. So that means it's not as important as something I can. And I think it's maybe not the polar opposite, because obviously if you have if you have something where you've broken something, definitely still go and see a doctor, but more so just like treat them the same, make sure your head is as fixed as the rest of you.
Yeah. And it is tough as well with the way the world is going, because there are certain elements to our lifestyles now that are leading to us having more mental health issues. In particular, the recent pandemic highlighted for people how close they were on that tipping point of mental health being a challenge, where maybe the ability to go to work was enough that kept them from feeling those symptoms or ignoring them even.
Yeah, I think one thing I'd like to add as well is if there are other people who have had like panic attacks, depression, all of these different things, they're not going to hold you back forever. Like if you sort them, because that's the thing, like, if me in my peak of my panic attacks ever tried to do a broadcast, it never would have happened because I would have been too nervous, too worried to ever step foot in front of a camera. So it's like, it's never going to be something that completely immobilizes or obliterates you if it's something you actually want to, or in my case, beat. Because that was always the way I look at it. I know other people would be completely different in their manner, but for me, it was like, I am going to beat this mental illness. And as I said, it's not gone, but I've done some of the biggest broadcasts in esports in front of thousands of people. And I can say that I wasn't sat there in the corner like shaking like I was when I was younger. And all of that's because I worked on it as if it was something like my homework, like I spent time on it. And that's the case. It's like for anybody who's in those sort of moments, it's like what you're going through is beatable. You've just got to firstly let people help you. And that was another thing. When I was at school, I was like, I'm never telling any of my friends I have a panic attack disorder because that's embarrassing. And then I told my friends and they were like, okay, that's it. It's okay. Like one of my best friends, he didn't even like really say anything else than that. He was like, oh, okay. Yeah. If you want to chat about it, cool. And I just thought they were going to be like, ha, what a loser. He feels his heart beating too quick when he gets nervous. It's like, that's so dumb. It's exactly what we were talking about earlier about thinking the worst thing.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I did at school, because firstly, people at school are mean. But I don't think anybody who does judge someone based on a mental illness is a piece of shit. And that's the only way you can ever put it.
Yeah. And I think what we mentioned about therapists, close friends, having family members, people to talk to, the key is find someone to talk to about it. And
worst case, send me a DM. I'll chat with you.
Worst case, you've opened up a...
Absolute worst. I don't mind.
Yeah.
If someone genuinely going through and something, DM me. I don't care. I have time.
As an ex-medical student in this situation, we were told, go see a doctor.
Definitely go see a doctor.
Yeah. So thank you so much for sharing, because that's potentially going to help someone's life. You just don't know who's listening. And there could be someone out there who's in a very similar spot to you were when you were 17. Yeah. And they just need to hear that from someone else. And
yeah, you will beat it. Trust me, I've done it.
So let's look ahead now. Let's move on about the future for you. So last year, you had an amazing year casting Valorant, and you're hoping to continue that next year.
Yes.
What's Valorant looking like in the future? Because it's a very different future to what we saw through the last few years of Valorant.
I think it's getting very exciting. Like it definitely has things that need to be put in place, because in any process where things become a league, it's always going to be dangerous, because you need to make sure that there's still basically somewhere for new players to go. But I think the way that Valorant is setting up is you've got the in-game client coming where you can compete from the very sort of beginning level, which I'm so excited to try and get absolutely smashed by like 17, 16-year-old Zoomers who are just going to be better than me. That's fine. But I like that so far Valorant has gone in with what looks like a clear plan, because it's like, okay, you have your main partnership league. That's where teams are going to be able to make money, because that's ultimately teams don't want to be involved if there's no way to make money. And in a lot of open circuits, that's where it becomes very, very difficult. So there's going to be those sort of like teams in each league that we're going to have lots of places for content, which I've already met some of, like, I've been able to work luckily with people like Fnatic and with spoken to like Foot Esports, the Turkish squad. Their CEO is fantastic. Like, they're so excited to be doing stuff next year. So I'm feeling very positive about EMEA, and I think NA and Asia are probably going to do just as well. But it's like, that's like the starting block, but then all these sort of different Ascension leagues and actually having a way into it. Because that was always the thing with like even with League, I don't know much about League, but I always knew like, oh, you have to spend X amount of money to get in, and it's a lot. Whereas in this case, there's no buy-ins. It's just the teams are going to work together to create something cool. And then teams who still want to be involved kind of fight through the lower leagues. So I think those leagues are actually going to be hella competitive and exciting. NA seems to just have so many good teams trying to do that. So it's going to be scary. So I'm really excited. And especially I don't think I've ever been I still don't know if I will be, but hopefully be involved in like the launch tournament, which just to have all 30 teams at an event is so exciting. Like, because it genuinely could be won by anyone. There could be a team that ultimately never really got to qualify for the event because they couldn't beat their own regional teams, who might be able to smash some of the top teams just by a different style of play. So I think next year is definitely setting up to be very, very cool, and hopefully it will be. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, with the advantage you got with Valorant is they are the newest esport, really, that's come in and gone from the start, right, we have to have a plan. And they can look at, Riot can look at League of Legends, learn from that. They can look at CSGO, learn from that scene. Look at every other esport. They can look at the way the Overwatch League came in and didn't work as well as it might have hoped to, and really try and hone all of those aspects into the perfect league.
One of the things that I've really, really loved, and the thing is, a lot of the time I'll always make comparisons to CS, but I'd say I wasn't at the very top of CS. So maybe some of this stuff does happen, but it didn't happen with me, where it's like, I will be able to directly talk to the people who influence our show, which is just amazing. Like, for example, I've been asked for inputs on stuff like HUDs. Like, okay, we're going to try out this new HUD. What do you think of this? Or, okay, we could try adding this. And then it gets added. And that's like something as a commentator you almost dream of in most games, where it's like your opinion is actually valuable to someone because they know that ultimately when it comes to casting the games, we're going to utilize this more than anyone else. Like, the viewers at home will need certain aspects of it, but ultimately they'll listen to what we say and then probably make their own opinion based off that. So it's been very nice when it comes to content ideas, or when it comes to how a show is going to be built, or even just who we're working with. Like, people are very, very willing to actually listen within Valorant, and it's almost like we're growing a product rather than you're part of it, but you have to listen to us, which ultimately we still do. But it's nice to actually have some sort of opinions involved in that sort of scene.
I mean, it's going in the right direction, and we've got a lot of exciting future ahead for Valorant. What about for you? So you've lived in the UK now for a few years, and
on and off.
You actually live fairly close to me, which is quite exciting. I don't know if you can leak this or if there's anything like that. What's the studio situation going to be? Because before, you used to cast from home, right? Is there potential we get to see that Mitch and Tom in person?
I hope so.
Together.
I'd say it's definitely leading in that direction. I don't know the plans of everything going on at the moment, because we don't have our stuff set for next year just yet. But, and especially with it being a few months away. But I do think that it is moving in that direction, because we already had like the analyst desk and hosts in studio, so it would make sense that the next step would be to get us in there as well. And that's what I hope for, because especially with the teams likely to be around that area now, having like the people building hubs and stuff, so it would be cool to just be able to go out there and make all the content and stuff. But we'll see. It depends how it's going to work with a wonderful old Brexit and stuff like that, just to make sure I can get everything sorted.
We'll see. I tried pulling out some secrets there, but I think you sort of summarized it as, I don't know.
That is mostly true.
And I guess it's also, there's still a lot of growing to happen. And if someone like Valorant comes in and tries to do it all too fast, I don't want to compare to Overwatch, but I felt like with Overwatch, their biggest downside was they did everything too fast.
Well, I think the biggest thing was just, What Valorant is trying to avoid almost, I feel like they have learned from Overwatch, is just making sure there is still a path for people to get in. Because that's always the thing. It's like when you have a closed league, it it basically means that only those teams can pick up players. So then for the other teams below, what's the point? Like, you either have to hope that someone just goes, I want to sell my slot for 20 million whatever dollars, and then you just have to have 20 million lying around. Whereas I'd like the fact that thus far there seem to be opportunities for team to actually grind through, and the fact that the league starts with 10, but we are planning to grow. So there will be like 11, 12, 13, 14 over the next few years. So it seems like they've got a plan. Whether the plan works as flawlessly as they hope it will, who knows? Basically, they're trying to plan to a point of longer than the games existed. So that's that's quite a challenging thing to do. Like, okay, the game has existed 2 years. We're going to plan for the next four. It's like, I think if anybody could do it, I think it is Riot, because they've literally built, I guess, the biggest esport that exists. And I know that there's going to be like some PUBG Mobile guys like, actually, we get 7 billion views. But it's like, I understand your game's pretty good as well. But like, they're the ones I look to when I think of an esports sort of scene. So hopefully it's going in that direction. And from what I've heard, I think everything's been very, very positive over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and you spoke about the positive experience from your side working for them, and how important that is to keep you in love with the game, keep you in love with the job, and feeling part of the whole system and everything.
Yeah.
So with Valorant as a game, you know, we played a little bit together. Sorry, you had to experience that. There has been times where I felt a bit like I'm so sorry that I had to cause that loss.
To be fair, I think you're doing yourself dirty. You're not bad at the game.
I do have an occasional game in me where I lack the ability
to
shoot.
Maybe I just witnessed those games, but I feel like you did pretty well.
We were solid. And when you play, obviously there's a lot of people out there who look at casters and they think, why is the caster not immortal or top of the ranks? And there is an element of, you know, you don't have the time to play it. What is gaming like for you? You mentioned about how hardcore you were when you were younger. What's gaming like for you with Valorant when you're not playing, like when you're playing off the job?
The thing is, it's like, it's weird because I play the odd game here and there, like still, and I definitely want, like over the last few weeks, I haven't played much, but just to give myself almost like the break from it, but not even just the break from Valorant, because I'm still making videos and stuff. But it's just like, I think if you spend a day making a video on something and then go and play that thing, it's like you'll just melt your brain. So it's like, I definitely want to grind into it a little bit more, but it definitely is that sort of like that solo queue just is daunting. Like it's because the other thing as well is like, from a commentator's point of view, I think most of the time I'm pretty good at like reading the opponents, but just getting a squad of 5 people to do what you think is so tough. It's just like, hey, by the way, we need to do this. No, I'm going to peek mid and run in and die. And I'm like, cool.
Yeah, thanks, 10 to 5 bro. Stack more than the solo queuing. Because when you're solo queuing, like you said, you don't have to work out what your teammates are doing.
But then again, that can be difficult even playing with some of the people we 5 stack with.
No names?
No, I'm not going to name any names, Zilf. But
Zilf, the Observer, has been called out. Yeah. To be fair, he had a pretty rough run where he was MVPing, playing with me and some other friends.
He's not bad at the game, but some of the times you'll call an entire strat and then he'll go, sorry, I wasn't listening. And he's just somewhere else. And I'm like, I hate you, Zilf.
I like to think he's got other priorities, like being a father. And
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, he does sometimes say, sorry, I'm going to have to AFK for a round.
Yeah,
if you're choosing
your kids over me, I'm not happy with that.
That's fair. Well, I thought it'd be fun just to end on a little bit of anecdotal stuff. We have played a little bit together. We have to play again soon. But thank you so much for sharing all of that amazing history of your career and also opening up about your panic attacks and everything. And I really do appreciate you coming on so early in Beyond the Game's life.
I don't mind. Part two
in the future. We'll be able to talk. Maybe we could get a part two where we get you and Mitch, and we can have
That's
like
dangerous.
A little couples therapy.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
We'll have to get another mic for that. But I really do appreciate you coming on this time. And as I mentioned, some of the things you spoke about, the advice about getting into the career that you've got, and then talking about some of the challenges you faced with your personal life. I think it will be really interesting for people to hear, and maybe even help someone out there who's struggling.
If one person gets some value from it, that's fine by me.
And thank you very much. And I do just want to say I look forward to hearing you cast again. One of the few casters in esports who I will not mute. And I think there you go.
Well, I think December the 10th. There you go. Rebel home ground. It's going to be a good day.
I'll tune in.
Rebel should sponsor this.
I'll tune in and I will keep your audio on. People think that sounds like a harsh thing, but it is a genuine thing amongst casters and talent and people in the game. It's really hard to listen to commentary when you're so used to.
Well, it's also, it depends what I'm doing. Like, if I'm VOD reviewing, a lot of the time I'm mute because I'm trying to pay attention to stuff that might not necessarily be the thing that the person talking is paying attention to. So I might go, oh, that's a good point. I'm like, what are you doing? You're trying to focus on this.
And I do think you're also quite blessed in Valorant. There's so many good casters. So I think most of the Valorant casters I do like
you
to listen
never
to.
Meet Pan.
No. But anyway, thank you again. And we end with the same question every time. What does gaming mean to you?
My life.
That was beautiful. Your life. Well, thank you very much, Tom.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I assume it will just cut up my life, but we'll find out. Yeah. There you go.
Nice. Can I touch this now?
Sports Social Podcast Network.